Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I am your host today for Focus Discussions. That's my second show on Blog Talk. I am an author. I am first and foremost an educator, reading and writing staff developer, book reviewer, and a whole bunch of other things. But today, I am totally excited. We have two unbelievably fantastic authors that are going to both be on the show today. We have our New York Times bestselling author, Cheryl Woods, and then we're going to have New York Times bestselling author, Iris Johansson. Before I welcome Cheryl first, and I am so excited to discuss her Chesapeake Shores series, I need to make two very brief announcements. My nephew Jake is going to be doing a baseball tournament for pediatric cancer on May 24th. It's on my Facebook wall. Any author that gives a donation of a dollar or more, I promise I will read your book. I can't promise you an interview on my show, but you never know. Surprises do happen. But if you give to Kyle's Camp, and I'll know you do it, I promise I will review your book, and you will be helping him with a birthday gift. His birthday is tomorrow. He's going to be 12, and this is something that he's doing on his own. Also, Marcus Bryan is now taking on, and they took me on, yay, as a client, Books to Movies. So if anyone has a book that they feel would be great for the TV screen, please contact Marcus Bryan and Marcia Casper Cook, and she'll tell you whether she feels that your book could be turned into a screenplay, into a movie. And they're taking my new book, Faces Behind the Stones. So that's exciting because that just happened 10 minutes ago. I'm excited. So now I would like to introduce my very first guest. Not only is she an author, but she was a journalist, and she's going to tell you something about herself. I would like to welcome Cheryl Woods. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Fran. How are you? And congratulations on the book to a movie deal. That's great.
Yes, I'm excited. I'm waiting to get the contract, and I'm also waiting for the contract for Faces Behind the Stones. Book two is going to be taken by World Castle, and it's told from the point of view of the person that's dead behind the stone. And the next one's going to be teen issues, and don't let this be your child. It's just to help parents understand, you know, what teens go through and before they become a face behind the stone. So tell everybody about your career and about you so that we can talk about your first series.
My background, as you said, is in journalism. I graduated from Ohio State 100 million years ago with a journalism degree and worked in newspapers in several different places and wound up, interestingly, as a television critic. And so I know how difficult it is to get these book deals turned into TV deals or movie deals and everything. So that's why I'm so impressed and so thrilled for you because it's a tough road. It's a very tough road. And I think from journalism, one of the things that I really learned was to listen to people, to observe people, and then to write concise, coherent kinds of sentences. And when I broke into the romance business, it was back in the 1980s when all the publishers were trying to develop category romances along the lines of Harlequin and Silhouette. And I was very fortunate in that because it was an exploding genre at that time, my very first book sold. I went through a period, I was working actually in a different kind of a job at that point. I was working for a medical center, and I sold 6 books in about a month and a half. And which is, it doesn't happen much these days, and to 2 different publishers. And that was sort of the start of it. And then I did that without an agent. And then all of a sudden I went through things that other authors have experienced where they're orphaned by an editor who leaves or the publisher changes directions and so on. Mm-hmm. And I stepped back, regrouped, found my agent, whom I've been with now for 28 years, and since then, we went from using pseudonyms to using my real name, Cheryl Woods. And, you know, I've done now about 125 books. I haven't counted lately, but I think that's about the ballpark.
I have a lot to catch up on and to read them.
Yeah, right. Get that checklist and start at the top. Yeah.
Yes, I'll tell you, I was very lucky, and I should tell our audience, there are a lot of people listening, I could tell you now. Hi, Karen. Hi, Delaney. Those are two other authors that constantly listen to my shows. We support each other. They're terrific. And what happens is that many of the – they're writing me little notes over here, right? Whatever. Finding an agent is really hard. And to be able to find an agent that's going to actually help you get out there is even more difficult. I know that. Because I know many new authors will say that they've tried to, you know, send to literary agents and stuff like that. And I know from experience that I've sent to several of them, too. And I also, you have to pick out the ones that are real and the ones that are not real.
Right, absolutely.
Marcia Cook is my agent, which I trust her. She's great. But I did send to some literary agents when I first wrote my first three children's books. And just to see if they actually read the book, I sent it with typos, just to see what they were going to say. I did it on purpose because I had a funny feeling. When I got back the thing, they said my grammar was perfect. It had no typos, and they were going to take the book. At that point, I knew that there had to be some kind of scam there. I emailed them back, "Do you have a phone number?" And you couldn't get them on the phone. They had several subsidiaries. Now, isn't it true that when you have an agent, they only get 10%, but they don't get anything until you sell something? And they wanted the foreign rights, and they wanted a whole bunch of other stuff. When I got one of their subsidiaries on the phone, they said to me, "Well, you have to pay for the emails." I said, "I don't have to pay for anything. I could do the emails myself."
Right.
At which point, you know what? You got to be careful. So
You
have three.
No, absolutely. I think that one of the things that I caution people all the time, and I hear from a lot of aspiring writers, is, you know, don't go with somebody who's asking you, like you said, for money up front.
Yeah.
You know, do your homework. Make sure they're credible. Make sure that, you know, what they're going to do for you. And, you know, I think royalty rates and the fees they charge and so on are easily recognizable as being legitimate. I mean, there's the Association of Author Representatives website, and I think a lot of things are posted there that can help you find that agent. And I think that's so important because it makes me crazy when I see these people who are trying so hard to get their books published and are so frantic and end up spending a fortune to somebody who's not really going to do the right job for them.
Well, I see we have my friends in the chat room asking questions. So you need to explain, tell everybody about your Chesapeake Shores series. And Karen would like to know, how was the transition from fiction to journalism or journalism to fiction?
You know, I have to say, and it's been a long time now, but I remember distinctly sitting down there looking at my blank page in the typewriter back then and saying to myself, where are my quotes? Where's my interview? Where's all my, you know, where are my facts? And finally somebody said to me, you get to make it up. Well, it's interesting because, of course, unlike what people sometimes think about journalists, in journalism you don't make it up. You have actual quotes and, you know, you do these interviews. And so it was very hard for me to make that transition that I could sit down and I could write whatever I wanted to write. Now, that said, my journalism background also gave me that I try very hard to do factual research so that if I'm stating something that's as a fact, it has credibility to it. And, you know, nothing makes me crazier than, it, you know, even these days I'll get an email every now and then from somebody who says, well, I'm a nurse in this particular field and we would not do it that way. Well, that may be true, but believe me, I've done my research where it is done that way. You know, and it doesn't mean that things aren't different in different places and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, I try really hard. The journalist in me won't let me fudge the facts. But it was a tough transition to go back. Now, the other piece of that, and I know I'm skipping ahead to some things we're going to talk about, is that I have in my Sweet Magnolia series later this summer a cookbook, which is nonfiction. And when we first started talking about it, I talked to the editor, the nonfiction editor at my publishing house, and said, you know, how are we going to handle this? Because I don't cook.
Neither
do
I.
Even though it's my cookbook and it's based on the Sweet Magnolias and the introductions to each of the sections are all mine, I was adamant that we put the name of the chef who developed all the recipes on the book, because I'm not going to go out there and pose as somebody who can actually make some of this stuff.
I can't even imagine that. My husband's cooking dinner as we speak, which is probably wise, because the last time I tried to make oatmeal last week, that was not a good thing either.
Oh, dear. You're having a lot of trouble with oatmeal these days, aren't you?
Yeah, I know. Between the bakery not making it and me, when my mom was sick with Alzheimer's, she would say to me, "You make the jello." I said, "Only if you want water." I said, "It's not going to happen." And, you know, what can I say?
Yeah.
So tell everybody about the Chesapeake Shores series and about Megan and Mick. When I read Driftwood Cottage first, I couldn't put it down. You know, and I read, as you know, I'm a speed reader, so that one I read in like no time. And then when I got the second one, I read that even faster.
Well, this particular series, I wanted to do, I love doing continuing stories. And when I was doing just even straight category romance, a lot of my books were connected before it became such a big thing for readers to like these books that go together and that kind of thing. But I wanted to create a series set in a small town in which the father was somebody who had developed this community from scratch and wanted to create this sort of perfect kind of environment. And yet, in the process of doing that and winning all this international acclaim, this is Mick O'Brien, all this international acclaim for communities he's developed all over the country and everything, planned communities, for all of that, his family is a mess. And Megan, his wife, has left early on because she felt like she was raising their five children completely on her own, and she could not get him to pay attention to the family the way that she thought he ought to pay attention to it. And of course, what added to the very twisted and conflicted relationships in the series is that when she left and went to New York, she had every intention of taking the five children with her, and she went up to sort of get settled and start her own new life. And Mick, very strong-willed person that he was, convinced her that the children would be better off in the community where they have family around and so on. And so she did what she thought in the end was the right thing by leaving them behind. And so consequently, when Megan comes back, and the original book was The End at Eagle Point, that was the very first book in the series several years ago. In that particular book, when Megan first comes back to Chesapeake Shores, the issues with each of the kids is very different now that they're grown, because they all had very different perspectives on what happened when she left, depending on their ages.
Yeah.
So the very youngest, Jess, felt like she was completely abandoned by her mother, because she was only 6 or 7, and she hardly even knew her. And the boys were old enough to kind of take Mick's side and felt very protective of him, and that, you know, they don't trust women, they don't trust marriage, they don't trust anything like that. And then the older daughters have very conflicted relationships between the two parents. They feel guilty if they associate with one. So through the course of the series, I've tried to develop each of their stories and those relationships. Mick and Megan actually had their own book in Chesapeake Shores Christmas a couple of years ago. And then Mick has two brothers with whom he has challenging relationships. And so one of the brothers has two sons and a daughter, and I've recently done their stories as well. So I've now gone through the whole family, and it's been very interesting, and it's been very interesting to hear reader reactions. Readers have taken to this particular family, and they identify with one character or another, or they like the fact that these people are so friendly and they meddle in each other's lives and all that kind of thing. On the other hand, I've had an interesting reaction from some people who think, well, my family's not like that. My family would never do X, or they would never do Y, or they would never jump in and interfere in this relationship and everything. And So for me, it's just very interesting to see how people identify with the O'Briens in general. And, you know, some people just laugh hysterically at some of the stuff they get involved in, and others don't quite understand it. And I think, you know, I've said quite a lot in the over the years that I think readers love connected books, whether they're families or friends or just within a community or whatever it may be, because it gives you a place to go back to. And so every time you pick up a book in that particular series, you have something constant. You know kind of the world you're going into. And I think with the way we all live our lives with families scattered all over the place and friends, you know, picking up and leaving. I certainly know that as a journalist. My friends are scattered all over the place. Once you've sort of been through that, you really like to go to a book and say, yeah, well, at least here, these people are going to be the same. They're going to be here for me. And I think that's the kind of reaction that I get from people. So I don't think I'm too far off base in thinking that that's what goes on. And that's what I see when I see people who read, whether it's Debbie Maycomer or Robin Carr or Susan Mallory or any of the other people mm-hmm. who do connected books. Nora Roberts has done quite a few connected books. Those kinds of things. I think that's what appeals. And it's always appealed to the mystery genre as well. People like to go back to that familiar character and see what's happening in her life, in her world, and kind of get brought up to date. And there's a comfort zone in there.
There's a question in the chat room that we need to clarify. This is a series, right?
Chesapeake Shores, yes.
Chesapeake Shores is the series, right? And there were like three books in this particular series, of which I read two, which is Driftwood Cottage and The O'Brien Family Christmas. And we'll get to that in a minute because there are two characters in there that I really think are cool.
There are actually eight books in that series.
Eight. I only read two. How come? This is not good.
The series started with the In at Eagle Point. The way I've done the series is there would be three books, and then I would break and do my other series for a
okay.
trilogy. So there was The In at Eagle Point, Flowers on Main, Harbor Lights, then Chesapeake Shores Christmas, then Driftwood Cottage, then, Moonlight Cove,
O'Brien.
Then Beach Lane, and then an O'Brien Family Christmas. And then what was supposed to be the last book mm-hmm. in the series was The Summer Garden, which was out in February. So
they're like wondering why I didn't read all of them, and somebody's telling to me, how could you not read them? I didn't know.
That's the thing. I mean, people come at a series oftentimes in the middle, and sometimes they go back and pick up the others. Sometimes they don't find the others, and sometimes they're perfectly content with whatever book they've read. And there are, I guess that's nine books in that series, two Christmas books, and yeah.
Well, I got this off of Manic Readers, and what happens is with that particular site, you have to be lucky. They put out the books, and I go on and I look for only print books. I won't read PDF or look because I can't. My eyes start to bother me. Besides, I need to scribble in the book and circle what I want to include, and otherwise that would spoil my fun.
Right.
And I went and got it on Manic Readers. I was really, really lucky. And formerly with Manic Readers, they did tell you that if the author says that they like your book or someone likes it, you can't say anything. You're not supposed to tell them. I was just lucky that they said, okay, no problem. You can tell Cheryl you liked her book. And from then I was like, I got the O'Brien Family Christmas. So whenever I see a Cheryl Woods book on Manic Readers, I go, I'll take that one. I'll take that one. And I just finished one by Lauren Willig, but it was the Pink Carnation series, and this one was only okay. It was okay. It wasn't bad. But you know what I like is the fact that your books are just the right length. That was the question I asked yesterday. They were just the right length, and it didn't drag on for 750 pages. So it's where the story.
That's a product of my journalism background and writing
yeah.
tight and concise. Is that in fact, when I went from writing just category books like for Silhouette Desire and Silhouette Special
mm-hmm.
Edition, there were a lot of people editorially wondering if I was going to be able to even get up to 400 pages or 450 pages for these bigger books. And you know, now I'm pretty comfortable in that zone, but I don't overwrite them. I got
No, you don't, because, you know, I've read books that are between 600 and 800 pages, and I really wish I had the book in large print so I could get done faster. I mean, I'm finding that, and my eyes start to bother me when the print is too small, or I get bored, so it's nice to be able to read something and say, okay, this book is going to say what it has to say, and I'm going to say, yay, this is great. So, let's see.
I might add something to that, I do think, I had a bookstore for a while, for about 10 years, and I noticed then that people, when they picked up a book, one of the first things they looked at, other than whether they liked the cover, the back cover copy, or the actual book, was the type size. And type size that was too small got put back on the shelf.
I've always
said to my publisher, you know, if we're going to have a certain number, you know, you need to tell me the number of words to keep my type size okay.
So I don't overwrite
and end up in a situation where they're trying to save paper and making the type size too small.
Well, anything that's 12-point or 14-point I find is too small. And I found that when my third children's book came out, the reason why people, you know, kids are having trouble reading it is because the type size is too small. And I said to them, use a 16 or even 18. My last book, Faces Behind the Stone, is in like large print, thank God. And it was sorted out to be like 70 pages. It's 176, but the print is larger, which makes it much easier. Which makes it easier for people to want to read. So when I gave it to the postman. I find that, you know, you give it to people that don't want it, what the heck, you're going to get it anyway. You know, just for mailing my book. Why not?
Right.
But there are several characters in both books that I really fell in love with, and two of them are Nell and Dylan. Could you tell everybody about them? I absolutely love those two because they're older.
Right. Well, one of the things in many of my series through the years is I love to do multi-generational stories. And so in this case, Nell is the grandmother. She's Mick's mother, and she's the one who ended up raising the children while he was off building communities and Megan was in New York. She's the one who had the primary responsibility for sort of keeping the family in one piece. And I like to bring those characters in for two reasons. One is I think that it adds a dimension of wisdom and perspective to the story. And I also like to do it because I want younger readers who read my books to look at older people with a different perspective than in real life.
Yeah.
And I think when you make that generation real to them, you know, other than, you know, they've got to go to grandma's house for Sunday dinner and they don't really want to, they start you hope that maybe a few of them will take another look. And I know I had an email one time from an older reader in her 80s, and she felt that I had done a disservice with a character, and I think it was in my Sweet Magnolia series, with an older character that I implied that she was not as fit and fiddle, or, you know, as fit as a fiddle. And she said, you know, I want you to know that, you know, people in their 80s are still feisty and da-da-da-da-da. I said, trust me, I know that. I mean, at the time, I had a very dear friend of my mom's in South Carolina who was 99, and my aunt was 98, and I said, you know, they're going to knock me upside the head if I don't treat older characters with the proper deference. And these were the feisty people I want to be when I grow up. I mean, I think that bringing that extra dimension into a story, and I mean, it's just for the same reason I also like to have kids in the stories, so that multi-generational thing, so that if somebody picks up the book as a teenager, they may find a teenager in some of these books that they can relate to and that the storylines relate to. I have lots of readers who are in their 70s and 80s, and they can relate to those characters as well as the story overall. And as far as Dylan is concerned, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. He's, you know, of course, he's Irish, and he was an old flame and got brought in mainly to drive Mick crazy, because Mick is having a terrible time imagining that his mother is actually involved with somebody. And so that was just fun. That was pure fun for me.
That is so true. She reminds me of a combination of my Aunt Tommy, because we called her Tommy, seriously, and my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And until the day my mother died last year, she was, you know, she knew who she was, even though she had Alzheimer's, and she let you know she was running the show.
Yep.
Forever. Yeah. You just did it her way, and it was just easier. She would just look at you and go, "Okay, Ma, don't worry about it. You don't have to even." She never raised her voice ever, and you just knew. You just listened to Ruthie, because if you didn't, your life was not going to be happy. It was just better. That's probably why.
The old saying: If Mama's not happy, ain't nobody happy.
It's exactly right. My father was 400 pounds when he died, and he was a big man, and my mother would look at him and go, "Okay, no problem." She just had her way about her, even with the home health aides. They would look at her, and my mother would say, "No, it's this way." I said, "She wants it that way, then that's the way you're going to do it." And
right.
That was her. Now, the other two characters in O'Brien Family Christmas that are just the opposite, the younger people, are Layla and Matthew. So they're adorable, but they have their own thing.
They do, and it was they were fun. I mean, Layla was very much a character in the very first book in The End at Eagle Point. She was her older brother was the hero of that particular book, and there was a lot of the family dynamic over who was going to run the family bank in Chesapeake Shores, and she was the one who was determined to do it, and her father really wanted his son to take over the family bank. And so there, you know, Trace had no interest in doing it. He had his own career, his own plans and everything. And he kept trying to convince his father to make Layla the person in charge of the bank and the future of the bank. And so when she gets involved with Matthew, who is younger and a playboy on top of it, it creates all sorts of havoc because you know, the father is just incensed and thinks that this is going to destroy the very respectable reputation of his bank if she's running around with this playboy. And so because she gets angry at her father's attitude, she quits the bank. But then she has no idea who she is or what she wants. But she's mad at Matthew because, you know, she blames him for causing her to do this and for the fact that he distracted her from what she thought was her life's work, so to speak. And so there's some interesting conflicts in there. And, of course, trying to get them back together in Ireland over Christmas, that was was another fun storyline. He was determined they were going to get married while they were there. And so they're trying to pull off this surprise wedding that she doesn't even know about. Only O'Briens would do something like that.
The O'Brien family sticks together. They really do.
There are not many
families that stick together, and you know it's great. I think that was what really drew me to the book because before my sister died last year, it was like my family was like that. I guess it takes one person to sort of tie it together. So I guess you have Nell and you have Dylan, and that's all I'm going to say about that because we don't want anybody to know what really happened in this story.
Right. Yes.
And then the other two characters that I found very intriguing that reminds me of, you know, a young couple that can't get along but, you know, has to figure it out was Connor and Heather. And what I really respected was that even though Connor, you know, he was what he was, that Megan, even though it was her son, sort of helped out Heather. I really thought that was really cool. So tell everybody just a little about them.
Yeah, their story actually begins. You begin to get a sense of their story in A Chesapeake Shores Christmas, where Heather shows up on the doorstep at Thanksgiving with a baby and says the baby needs to be with his father, and off she walks. Well, the baby is named Little Mick. So for a brief moment, everybody is terrified and sitting there looking at Mick. You know, did he somehow father a child? And so there's that really created some havoc, let me tell you. And then they figured out that it was Connor's. And so Megan makes it her business to try to get Connor and Heather back together again in A Chesapeake Shores Christmas. And at that point, Connor's having no part of it. He doesn't believe in marriage. He loves Heather. There's no question. I think, you know, having read Driftwood Cottage, I hope you had the sense that there was no question that he loved her and that he loved his son and that he wanted a family. He just didn't want to get married because he saw what happened with his parents. And he just doesn't think that it's worth the agony of the piece of paper. And that, you know, the commitment's there, that's all you need. And that's not enough for Heather anymore. And so trying to bring them together in Driftwood Cottage and have him, and one of the things that was a lot of fun in that book, you know, and I hope I'm not giving too much away at this point. But
no, you're not. We won't let you do that.
was the fact that, you know, when he has his epiphany that, you know, if he doesn't marry her, he could lose her. When he has that moment of an epiphany, and then he proposes to her out of the blue, and she says no, because she doesn't trust it. And so, you know, you think this is the turning point we've all been waiting for, and now it's Heather who's saying, hold on, bud, you know, not just yet. Let's think this through a minute. And she has her own issues that she was completely unaware existed.
That was a great twist in the story. I said, like, oh, wait a minute, now what's going to happen?
Yeah, you see, yeah. I mean, that's what I think one of the things that I love the most about writing, and particularly, you know, after as many books as I've done, is when a book takes a twist that surprises me. And, you know, I hate to go all kind of woo-woo, but when every now and then a book does something you don't, or a character does something you don't expect them to do. And it used to happen in my mysteries. That was always a big thrill. You know, in my mysteries, books would take a completely different turn and the wrong person would have done it. And I was, you know, then I was like befuddled. But that's the joy of writing for me, is to have a story go along. And I mean, and I plot them out. I do plan. But when it all of a sudden takes this little twist, then what you hope is that it makes it fun for the reader, or it makes it interesting or exciting or challenging, or gives them something to think about. You know, how would I react if that happened? You know, I it's interesting because I know so many people have through the years dismissed romance as being, you know, formulaic, or boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back, everybody lives happily ever after. To the extent that there's a formula, you know, that's there. There's no question about that. But within that, there's thousands of things you can do. I mean, every single person you know has a different story and a different way that story has plotted out. You know, and I used to do some writing exercises with a couple of workshops and would give people, the class, a basic set of facts. And say, now, come on, here with your basic set of facts, write me an opening scene, just a few pages of an opening scene. And with the exact same basic set of facts, every person in the room would write something wildly different. And I think that's how you can end up writing lots and lots of books, is that every story has a different twist to it. And that's the most fun of all this stuff.
I probably bored myself to tears years ago. Now, your books are anything but, if I can read them in an hour, forget it.
Yeah.
Okay. Karen, your work is not like that. It's very good. She has a question. If you're writing a series, or any author is writing a series, how do you know it's time to stop writing that particular series and start a new one?
You know, I grapple with that a lot, so it's a very good question. I did a series, one of my earlier series was done for Silhouette Special Edition a long time ago, called And Baby Makes Three. And in that series, I had an older character, Grandpa Harlan, and I made a decision to stop the series because I did not want Grandpa Harlan to die. And so for me, because he was so prominent in those books, and it's very much like Nell in Chesapeake Shores, I originally envisioned the series of Mick's children and his brother's three children, and that would be the end of the series. And so with The Summer Garden, I felt like the series was done. And part of the reason for that was because Nell, to me, was so integral to the books, and I just could not imagine allowing her to die on my watch. Of course, as soon as I, you know, made it clear that this was going to, Summer Garden was going to be the last book, I started getting emails and Facebook posts and all that kind of thing. And I'm easily guilt-ridden. I am very easily guilt-ridden by readers. And so, you know, they're all saying, oh, please, this makes me so sad, and on and on and on. So I have agreed to do two more in the series, just Christmas books, but two more in the series. And what I'm telling readers they must do is that I have to be allowed to age the grandchildren in soap opera time so that they're old enough for their stories, but Nell will not age. So
that's
Nell
good.
Is just going to be sort of an amorphous being that is going to be there. We're not going to know quite how old she is, even though we knew before, because I don't want her to go, and I think she's too important to the series and her perspective's too important to just write her out. You know, it was a real quandary for me. Now, I've had other series that I designed to be three books, and when I finish, and that's all I intended to do. Sometimes the only way to do that, if people are used to you writing series, is to not let there be another single character in the series that anybody can say, oh, but you could do so-and-so's story. So I try to marry everybody off in those three books if my intention is to only write those three books. So there's nobody, no little dangling
trilogy,
thread
right?
over here that a reader can say, oh, but what about Joe? You know, he needs a book. And, you know, it's interesting because in 2013, I have a new series starting, and I designed it as a trilogy about three sisters. And I have been very clear with the publisher. This is a three-book package. That's it. There's three books. There's no more. Well, even as I was writing, there's some characters who popped up in book two. And I'm thinking, they might be interesting. So, you know, sometimes it's the best laid plans of, you know, mice and men that I start something with the best of intentions, thinking I have eliminated all possibilities for extending something. And even I will go back and say, there might be something else I could do here. But I think sometimes it's if you don't have the right stories. In my Sweet Magnolias series, there's a certain kind of story I like to write. They tend to be a little more issue-oriented, so to speak, in some ways. And for those, I can continue on in that community and without the fear that I'm, like, extending it too long. At least I don't think I am. I hope I'm not. But there are others that I feel like they do have a natural ending, either because you'll be straining to come up with the storylines or you'll be taking it out of the realm of what you set out to do to begin with. And so I think it's very personal. And as I said, it's easier if you're not guilt-ridden the way I am, because readers can often change my mind. I hate to say, I shouldn't say that, because the next thing you know, they'll be begging for something else. But I don't like to disappoint. I'm a little people pleaser, and I don't like to disappoint people. So when they're really loving some characters, I'm thinking, how could I do this? Could I possibly do such and such? And so I never rule anything out, even if I don't have any intention of going back to it. I don't ever rule anything out, because I could wake up tomorrow and I have this brainstorm for a continuation of the series I wrote 10 years ago and say, oh, let me go back to that.
Now where am I here? Okay. I mirror my questions. I think I lost track of what I was doing. No, I don't. I have it right here. Okay. As a romance novelist, you created a plot with a definite message to readers, especially in this series. What do you hope readers will take away after reading these books? What do you hope they will learn? And what do you hope families will learn from the O'Briens? Because I think everyone can learn something, which is really what drew me to your book. It's just that there's an issue and then there's a message. And I don't read every type of romance novel. These I read because there's a message in them, and they're written in such a way that I really like them. And then there were certain romance novels that, you know, there are certain scenes in them I just don't even bother to read, if you get
right.
my gist.
Yeah.
I skip over them, and if they get too detailed, I feel like, I can't deal with this. That's ridiculous. You know, you need something to the imagination. So
right.
as a romance novelist, you create a book with a definite message. What do you hope that everyone takes away from this particular series after they read it?
I think in this one, I with the Chesapeake Shores and the O'Briens, I feel like maybe people will take away something that you said earlier, that families should be there for each other, that they should try to be closer if they can be. And I think that it also, each individual book within that series, hopefully they'll take away something about no matter what difficulties are going on in your life, you mm-hmm. can triumph over them. And you can, you know, that I suppose to reduce it to its most simplistic, love conquers all, in the sense that anything, and I'm backing up cliche after cliche here, anything worth having is worth fighting for. And sometimes I think in this day and age, people give up on love, on marriage, on relationships in general, the minute it's not fun anymore. And I think that I hope people can take a look at some of these and see that maybe if they worked a little harder, that just around the next corner is the turn that is going to make it all worthwhile. You know, I mean, I'm an eternal optimist, I'm afraid, and I think that I always believe that if you work hard enough, if you try hard enough, things will work out. Now, I know from, you know, my own life and watching friends around me that that's not always true. But I do think that if you have that attitude, it's more likely than if your attitude is, why bother?
Yeah, no, my mom was like that. You know, you can do it. I think there were three things she told me never to say. I can't. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know how. And I don't know. Ever.
Right.
It was,
right.
Yeah, I'll try, I'll find out, and I'll do my best. You
yeah.
are never, never, never allowed to say, I can't, I won't, or I don't know. And,
that's great,
or I give up.
Right,
I
right.
mean, there was
well,
always
and
a way,
I think,
yeah.
you know, one of the lines my mother used to use all the time is, nothing beats a try but a failure. And so, you know, trying is the most important thing. And if you try, you might succeed. And the only thing that's going to keep you from succeeding is if for some reason something doesn't go your way. But at least then you've tried. And, you know, so I think that I think we must have had similar moms in that, you know, we were taught to be strong, to be that anything was possible. I mean, and I don't know about your era, but my era was, you know, in terms of, it was interesting because in terms of women's lib, I never really thought about glass ceilings and things like that because I was brought up to believe I could do anything, that it was not affected by whether or not I happened to be a woman. And so I went about doing things that, and then I would later realize, gee, I was the first woman to do X, Y, or Z, and you know, it's some small microcosm, but you know, I was the first woman to get to do that. And it was like, oh, I wonder, you know, it didn't seem like I was doing anything special at the time. But as it turned out, and it was because I had parents who encouraged that and who drilled that into my head that anything was possible if you tried hard enough.
Yeah, my mom was like that, you know, to a point. But when I was growing up, my father, I could do anything except play sports, and. It's a true story. I mean, it was scary. My sister was very athletic. She could do anything. I had two left feet, and I still have three left feet at times. And, yeah, we went to the country, and my mother said, you know, when it comes to reading or writing or helping kids with homework or anything, she would say, if a family member needs you to do something, you stop what you're doing, and you just do it and help them out. And that's what I had no choice but to do. But with playing punch ball, and I was a punch ball freak, I was great. My dad would say to me, you go stand by the tree and keep score. I said, but Dad, they're not going to score that high. I can count up to five, and I can keep score. And I got home runs every single time. I could hit a ball, and I never had to run. I was overweight when I was a kid. I'm not overweight anymore. And the joke was, you know, Fran's going to stand by the tree and keep score while everybody else plays ball. And when, you know, one side was losing, I go, if you really want to win, I can get a home run and clean the bases for you. And, yeah, I mean, I never had to run. I was 180 pounds. Now I'm 107 pounds. And, yeah, for real. And I was always overweight. And she said, my mother would say to my father, why can't she doesn't need to play because, you know what, she's only going to fall and break her head. And, yeah, you can do anything you want to do if you set your mind to it, if no one tells you that you're not supposed to do it. And
right.
It wasn't because I was a girl. It was because my dad said, you know, that's just not going to work. But what I love about the characters in this book is that they don't give up until they get the job done.
Right,
you know, they, I mean, we're not going to tell them how they get the job done or if they get the job done, but they won't do anything. They won't give up, and they don't take no for an answer, whether you like it or not, which is really, 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 really cool. My other favorite character, I got to tell them, and then we have about 15 minutes. I want to talk about your other series, the Sweet Magnolia series, which I do have the titles here. I have everything. Matthew. He's really cute. And he wanted Layla to come over to Ireland to celebrate Christmas with his family, right? Which is especially the gist of that one. But tell everybody, we have a couple more minutes left, about your other series that Fran didn't read that she's going to read, which is the Sweet Magnolia series, which is Home in Carolina, right?
The first book in that series was called Stealing Home. And Home, and then A Slice of Heaven, Feels Like Family. Boy, I'm doing these off the top of my head. Feels Like Family, Welcome to Serenity. Then Home in Carolina, and there's one in the middle, Honey, and then Honeysuckle Summer. And then there are these three new ones coming this summer. And this particular series started about three friends in a small South Carolina town. And again, one of the things that has been so important to me through my life as an only child is strong friendships. And, you know, from people that I've known since elementary school. Earlier today, I was at a funeral of somebody I've known since I was 12. And he and there were, I think, three or four of us still there who had known each other since that era. And we've been good friends ever since. And so I wanted to write about those kinds of friendships that last a lifetime. And in the series, of course, it's women who have been friends for all this time and who know each other's history and have each other's backs. And no matter what's gone on, they're there to support each other. And it's a series that has allowed me to deal with probably a few more contemporary kinds of issues. I know in Honeysuckle Summer, which was the last book of the last trilogy before the upcoming ones, the heroine had agoraphobia because she had developed it after she had an abusive marriage and she couldn't leave the house. Well, you try telling an editor you want to write a book about a heroine that can't leave the house, and it kind of strikes terror in their hearts because what on earth are you going to do with the story? And so it was an interesting exercise as a writer to try to create an interesting, compelling story and a relationship and deal with both the abuse that she'd experienced and the psychological disorder she was experiencing and how it limited her and how she could break through it and so on and so forth. And then what I really, really wanted to do, because it is so prevalent these days and makes me so crazy, is I wanted to do a story about bullying. And this seemed to me to be the right series for that story. So in the books that are coming this summer, Midnight Promises is the first. It comes out at the end of June. And then Catching Fireflies is the book that is about bullying. And it's the second book. It comes out at the end of July. And that's the one in which, you know, I've introduced some new characters to the town, but both the hero and the heroine have some background, some familiarity from their past with aspects of bullying for very different reasons are compelled to help this teenage girl whose life is being destroyed by these bullying co-workers, but students. And it gives me a chance to deal with hopefully teenage emotions in a very real way and to deal with how a community rallies to back up the teachers and the child and to say that in this town bullying is not acceptable and so on. And then in the third book, which is called Where Azaleas Bloom, and that comes out as well as the cookbook at the end of August, in that particular book, I've got a single mom who's struggling to get food on the table because her ex-husband is not living up to his obligations of getting them financial support, and they may lose the house and all that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a whole book that, yes, it's about the current economic problems that people are having, but it's a really strong story, I hope, about a woman who is facing this trial in her life and trying to develop the kind of strength it takes to be the mom her kids need to get through this patch. And there's the hero in the story, who's been a character in earlier books, is someone who is willing to, he's always rescued damsels in distress, and he's always had a soft spot in his heart for this particular woman, but he's wise enough to sit back and let her find her own way while letting her know that he's there every step if she needs him. And I think that that gives a depth to their relationship that's really very special. So, and then at the end of the summer, also at the end of August, is this Sweet Magnolia's cookbook, because people have been asking for all these recipes, because one of the key characters in the book has a restaurant and is a chef. And so every now and then I talk about all these delicious foods, none of which I can make. And people were asking for recipes all the time. And so we did. We went out and we found a Southern chef who happens to be a reader. She emailed me as a reader and loved this particular series because she identified with the chef in the series. And I said, well, do you by any chance have any desire to help write a cookbook? And so it's actually a fan who's ended up doing the recipes for the cookbook.
And that is great. The first book I ever reviewed was a cookbook, believe it or not.
Oh, I mean, really? Yeah.
Well, that was the very first one.
I think people who like the series are going to like the extension of this, and then there are plenty of people, as you know, who just love cookbooks. And, you know, this one has great recipes and some beautiful pictures, and so I hope it's going to be appealing on many different levels. It's a whole new venture for me, and you know, I can't claim any of the success as far as the recipes are concerned, but I think it's going to be fun for people who like the series.
I think so too. If anybody is having trouble in the chat room, or anybody is having trouble getting kicked out, just please log in again or call in again. Because they seem to be having trouble getting kicked out of the chat room. On Tuesday, I almost got kicked out of my other show.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we have trouble with Blog Talk once in a while, and Delaney's having trouble hearing. I don't know. She has to press play on the top and see what happens. Sandra, are you there? I can't tell if my assistant is there either. Iris is not here yet. Okay, she's just telling me she's there. She got kicked out also. This happens.
Oh, dear.
This happens tons. This happens a lot. Now we have time for more questions. One good question here is: if the series is coming out in the end of August, right? I'm just looking at my schedule. We're going to have to set up another interview for you so that you can come back on and tell everybody about it.
The first book of the series comes out at the end of June, and the Mira publicist and the publicist in New York is setting up all the radio type things and all the interviews for that. We have a specific date set aside that I'm trying to do everything, because I usually take July off, so we're trying to get everything in at the end of June to really kick the series off. So I'll email you the contact information.
Okay, great.
And let them do the scheduling, because if I try to do it, I'll just mess up their lives, and they'll be very.
No, that's okay. Just email me. That's no problem, because I may take off August. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I've got four shows next month out of nowhere, and I've got two that I'm doing and another one in June. I haven't decided on July yet. I may take that off. Maybe not. I don't know. Probably not. August, I'm actually going to do something I haven't done in 15 years, go on an airplane.
Oh,
and I have acrophobia. And I haven't been on a plane in a long time because my mom was sick, as I said. So I decided that my niece is turning 16, and whether Danny wants her aunt there or not, she's coming anyway, just because my sister would, if she were here, would want me to be there. So someone's got to keep the family together.
That's right.
I'm going to have to see what I can do about getting things back the way it was, so they can annoy me every day, call me and bother me and say, are you there? And can you take
right.
me shopping and use your credit card?
There
okay.
you go.
Yeah, I have. So when you write all of your books, the target audience could be just about teens, or it could be older people or younger. It could be anybody, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The age
right,
range
right.
in terms of the email I get tends to be from teens all the way up through people in their 80s. Because, and again, part of it is a little of what we talked about. People think, you know, they're basically, quote unquote, quote, clean books. There's not a lot of graphic
yeah.
sex. And, you know, and the language is relatively tame. Every now and then a character slips up, but not me, of course, but
mm-hmm.
my characters.
No,
of course
not.
And, but in general, you know, I think they're suitable for all ages. And the generational storylines, I think, give each of those different age ranges characters they can identify with. I mean, that's what I'm hoping is happening anyway.
It is, because it's for just about everybody. So you can't say that the book is just for people that are younger or older. It's just, as you said, it is for everyone. So if you could, I'm going to really get, this is a good question. If you could decide which character out of all of them is your favorite.
Oh, my.
I tend to do that because, you know, I have my favorite character. I won't say which one. But
yeah.
which character do you think is your favorite out of all of them?
Well, in terms of these particular series, in terms of the O'Briens, I guess in some ways I would have to say Mick. I think that, you know, Mick is in some ways just this lovable, interfering person who, you know, is trying to make up for all the things he did wrong. And so I find him very appealing, and I, you know, have hopefully redeemed him from his earlier mistakes through the course of the books. And then, of course, on the flip side of that, Nell would be certainly one of my favorites, because I think she's offers the overall wisdom that people need to have around them, and that can guide them through life and give them a different perspective on what's happening in their lives and so on. In all of my books, I don't know. You know, it's interesting because people ask, just even if I have a favorite book, and the one that comes up is one that was out many years ago and then was reissued just in the last few years, called Amazing Gracie. And I think that one, because not only did I love the characters in it, but it's set in a small beachfront town in Virginia, not unlike the town where I spend my summers, where I am right now. And so, as one of my friends said, he says, I get the feeling you were sitting on your front porch and just looking and observing what was around you and writing about it. And to some degree, that is exactly what I did. I mean, it has a very personal feel to me. So it's probably still available, still out there. But Amazing Gracie is probably, if I had to pick one book of all of them. But I have reasons in every single book. There may be, I think out of all the books I've done, there are only a handful that I went, oh, what was I thinking? And the others, even if they weren't very successful, either commercially or creatively, if I accomplished what I wanted to do in that particular book as a writer, because I always hope I'm learning something with every book too, and that I'm not static as a writer and getting too formulaic or any of those kinds of things. I think that makes it each book a challenge and each book fun, and hopefully it comes across that way for readers too.
One question that other authors, well, Iris isn't here, so I get to ask more questions then. I don't know what happens. She should be here in a second. Who knows? When your first novel was it called Restoring Love? That was your very first one?
Actually, the first novel I wrote was a book called Sandcastles. The first novel published was Restoring Love. It just so happened that one sold before the other and got into print before the other, even though it wasn't the first one. But Restoring Love, and they were written under two different pseudonyms. Restoring Love was written under my Suzanne Sherrill pseudonym, which I only did two books with that pseudonym for Dell. And then Sandcastles was written under my Alexandra Kirk pseudonym, and I did three books under that pseudonym. And then when I, by then is when I got my agent, and we went with my real name, and that was the end of the playing games with my name.
Well, they, you know what? Sherwood is great. I didn't read the other ones. And before we go, could you tell everybody, because I have a few more questions until next person, where can they get your books?
They're pretty much available everywhere. The newest ones are always in Target, Walmart, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all those things, even in grocery stores. Target and Books A Million are getting better about carrying some backlist, so you can often find a few of the older books that have been reissued in there on the shelves. And at Books A Million and Barnes & Noble, you can often find backlist titles. Many things are available as ebooks anymore. I'm personally not a big ebook fan in the sense that I want a real book in my hand. I like to carry one in my purse. I have one in the car, and that's the way I learned to read. That's the way I'm happiest reading. And I understand all of the many reasons people like their ebook readers, but I just still want my real book, I'm afraid. I want to do a campaign to get people to go into bookstores and keep buying real books. That's just.
I won't review an ebook, and I won't review a PDF, and I won't review paper. If it's not paper, forget it.
Right. I want to see the real book in my hands. And, you know, people talk, one of the reasons that the e-readers are so popular, I'm told, is because if somebody's going on a trip, they can take their 10 books in their Kindle or their iPad or whatever.
Yeah.
And I happen to love my iPad. It's like attached to my arm. But I don't read books on it. And, yeah, that's great, but I'm perfectly happy taking, you know, 4 paperbacks stuffed into my suitcase, and then if I finish one, I leave it on the plane, or if I finish one after I get someplace, I leave it in the hotel or pass it along to somebody who's traveling with me. I don't have a problem with doing that and leaving them behind. The other reason that people I understand, particularly boomer age and my age and so on, is that they don't want to accumulate more books. Trying to figure out what to do with the books becomes problematic, and so the ebook solves that issue. But it's still not the way I really want to read. I can't make myself. And part that may also be because I'm on the computer so much as it is, that looking at a screen for more of the day would not be my favorite thing to do.
Well, I want to thank you so very much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Fran. I appreciate it, and I appreciate all your listeners and your chat room folks. And
we've got a ton of people in the chat room. Let me tell you, and just let me know if and when you can do another interview with me. It doesn't have to be in June. I could do September and October too. I intend to book them all over the place.
I will give you the contact information for the publicists and let them know that. You know, that you and I have talked about trying to schedule another one.
Great. And if when your new titles come out, I get them. I have to have them to read.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. You are the best. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Iris?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I am fine. How are you?
Oh, just thrilled. I have to tell you that this series, this new book, What Doesn't Kill You, I mean, I love Eve Duncan. I really love Catherine, I have to tell you.
I love Catherine. And
this
you
book
know,
put you over the top, I have to tell you.
Well, I had to do something completely different. Yes, she's Eve's friend, but she couldn't be anything like Eve, not really, except in the fact that she's a mother and that she has her own code. Other than that, she's completely different.
Yes, she is. She's totally not Eve. And yet, they are friends, correct? They are good friends.
Oh, yeah. They're very good friends. And it's a very strange type of relationship because neither one of them really have friends.
Yeah, that is very, very true, because Eve is transfixed on Joe, and Catherine, well, you can't, John is gorgeous. And, you know, I'm sitting here, and I read it, and I don't want to give away too much about the plot, and I'm just saying Eve, you know, had her relationship with him, and lucky Catherine, maybe she'll get him, because you can't let a gorgeous man go to waste. I know.
And he's sexy. He's very devil, isn't he?
Yeah,
I really like John. I couldn't let him go away.
I don't blame you.
I'm sure he'll be around for quite a while. I don't know if he'll always be with Catherine. You know, you never can tell.
Well, with Irish, you never can tell. We're not going to tell anybody that. So
no,
why did
not.
You decide to write a standalone for Catherine? I have to tell you, I've read every single one of the Eve Duncan books. Every single one of them. And then when I was surprised in the mail and I got this book, I just posted the review yesterday. Because I promised John that I would not post it until the book came out. And I'm saying, like, I got to post this. I read this in, like, no time. And it's just, this is my favorite one, I have to tell you. What doesn't kill you really could kill you. It's great. It's just so different. So could you tell them just a little bit about it? Not a lot, a lot. Just a little bit of a summary so everybody, because, guys, if you didn't read it and didn't go out and get it on Amazon, what are you waiting for? This is really good.
Yeah, what are you waiting for?
That's exactly right. You just go on Amazon and get What Doesn't Kill You by Iris Johansen. You can do it while you're talking to me, too. It's okay.
Actually, it's a story. It really concerns Catherine Ling's background quite a bit. I wanted to get to know her, so I went back into her background when she was 14 years old in Hong Kong, and I wanted to know what made her what she is. And what she is you know, a fantastic CIA agent, someone who can care about people and yet is tough as nails. So I went back into her past to find out exactly what, and guess what I discovered there? I discovered Hu Cheng, who is her best friend. I think I mentioned him first in Chasing the Night, but... He is, I really wanted this book to be about friendship as well as passion and suspense. So I had to sort of spread the entire spectrum around. And for friendship, I brought in Hu Cheng. And for the passion, what about John Gallo? Wonderful John Gallo. And the suspense, well, that grew from there. Yes, it does have a story with worldwide implications as far as the suspense plot is concerned, but it goes deeper. I had to just sort of weave in the story of Hu Cheng and her past and bring it up to date with John Gallo. And actually sort of have a little glimpse of what the future might bring. I really love writing this book. I was so excited all the way through it.
Yeah, this one really is so different from the other ones. And, I mean, I love Eve Duncan. And Joe, well, forget about him. If John's around, he's like, forget about it. he's a great character, but you can't compare to this guy. Forget it. I mean, like, how could you even think about it?
No,
I could see where
whole websites about Joe. So I'm sure you're going to get lots of people saying, no, Joe's the one.
Joe is great for Eve. He really is. He's perfect for her. And someday maybe you'll let them get married, but I don't know. And I love Jane. I think that she's really cool, and she comes in, you know, just at the right moment, and, you know, in your books too. But there's just something about John Gallo, and there's just something about his relationship with Catherine in this book that's just absolutely amazing. And, you guys want to read it, because I'm not going to tell you any more than that.
Well, they're both grown-ups, and
and
their relationship is very grown-up.
That's all.
And at the same time, passionate and a little quirky.
Yeah, they sort of have their own little form of banter back and forth. and you never know when he's going to show up, or you never know what she's going to do next, which makes it great. And of course, there's Hu Chang, and who I absolutely love him. Absolutely,
well,
think
I
this
too.
Character
I love
is
him.
So great. I mean, he's got to come back, and well, there's more to tell. I know that he's absolutely great, and why he's there, we're not telling anybody because they have to read the book to find out. And you definitely won't be disappointed, seriously. And I did post the review yesterday with 10 stars, but they only let me put 5. And we won't tell you how I did it because, like I said before, Amazon thinks I got paid, but you know what? I'm very smart. And I have a way of doing things that no one can figure out, including myself. It is on Shelfari. It's on Goodreads. It's on my Facebook. Well, it's everywhere. So if anybody wants to know what the book is about, I didn't give away too much. And if I did, you read it anyway. Don't worry about it. Okay. This book is much different than the Eve Duncan series. So do you ever see, I know that they worked together before. Do you see them coming together again? And do you think maybe they're going to fight for John? And Eve is going to have her doubts?
I don't think so. Will they come together again? Almost
yeah.
certainly, because they're very good friends. And I can see them walking in and out of each other's books quite a bit. But they're both very mature, and they wouldn't fight over a man.
Oh, that's no fun. That's good. But they're very good.
Sorry about that.
Catherine is very straight laced, and Eve is very straight laced. And I'm just waiting for one of them to have, you know, like a touch of humor. I think Jane brings it. Jane brings the humor to she sort of doesn't tolerate Eve when she shuts her out either. So where does this particular book take place, and what research did you do to write this?
Oh, well, most of it was research about, I actually lived in Texas for a while, and a lot of the suspense story is in Texas. And Hong Kong, which is where a lot of the past history for Catherine takes place, I just had to do that in research. I didn't go over there myself, but my son absolutely loves the East, and if I had a question, I'd talk to him about it.
That's great. That is great because you have your automatic research person over there, which makes it even better.
Oh, yeah, and of course Roy's a writer, too, so you know, it's perfect.
Well, that was one of my other questions that I'm going to ask in a minute about co-authoring a book, because that's kind of like interesting, because I know that there are a lot of authors that co-author a book, and there's, you know, there are different ways to do it, I guess. So how does this book differ in plot line and character development than the other books?
What, from the Eve books?
No, this particular book on this last one, What Doesn't Kill You, is different than the Eve Duncan books, right? Yeah, it is. It's different. The plot line is much different.
Mm-hmm.
How did you decide on the plot line for this one? What made you decide this particular subject? We won't tell them what it is. What makes you made you decide this particular subject?
It just came. My usual philosophy of writing is you get a kernel of an idea, and then you decide who is going to be in the book, and you get to know the characters very, very well. And then after you start the book, you just let the characters take over.
Okay.
I wish I could say, gee, you know, I spent 6 months outlining this book, and chapter by chapter, but it doesn't happen with me. I wish it did. It would be so much easier.
No, the characters...
Because I never know what the characters are going to do.
You know, a lot of people have said that. One of the questions I asked yesterday on my show was, and I think this was an interesting question that everyone answered, what's great about your books is that if someone hasn't read the one before it or whatever, it doesn't matter, because you usually include some kind of a backstory, right, in your writing, so that if you're not really know the character, you're going to know the character. Do you find that that does help readers to want to read the book, because you do tell something about the past of the characters?
Oh, you have to do it. There's no question about it. It wouldn't be fair otherwise. I'd hate to go in blind on a book and just try to have to figure it out for myself. So, yes, you definitely, you do. And sometimes it may annoy some of the readers who have read my past 12 books, like on Eve. Mm-hmm. But they stay with me and say, okay, here is the page where that she's going to explain everything that happened to Eve so that everybody else will understand it, even though I already do.
I've got a question for you in the chat room. Do you have any idea what your ending is going to be, even if you don't plan the rest of the story?
No. Very rarely do I know where a book is going to go. For instance, on Bonnie, everybody was particularly interested about that one, and I kept getting the question, did you know who killed Bonnie? And I honestly did not know until I first started the book, Bonnie, who it was. I didn't know during the first two books at all.
Well, you sort of kept it a good secret because it was a good secret until the end of Bonnie.
Well, I think that perhaps I did know somehow, but if I did, it was purely subliminal because I looked back at the other books later and there were little bitty things in it that I thought, maybe I did. But I didn't really know. I couldn't, as far as I was concerned, I didn't know until like a third of the way through Bonnie exactly what was going to happen. And even then, I didn't know exactly what was going to happen. The story had to develop on its own.
It usually does. It's hard because new authors, it's difficult. So is the next one going to be an Eve book or a Catherine book or something different?
Okay, the next book comes out in July, and it's a book that I wrote with my son.
That was my next question. How do you co-author a book with your son? And what part do you write and what part does he write? Or do you just say to him, just write that?
This is Close Your Eyes. And
sounds good.
And I think everybody's going to love it. It's got interest in Hollywood and New York already. This character is, Kendra Michaels is fantastic. And I had so much fun, both of us did, writing this one. And your question was, which part do we write? Well,
how do you co-author a book? Yeah.
Okay, it's different, I think, for anyone that writes with somebody else. As far as my son and I, we get together on a general outline of the book, but he's like me, and we both write by the seat of our pants, so you can never tell. We really do. And so I usually try to take a couple of the chapters in the beginning so that I can get to know the characters really well. That's important for me. And since he's a script writer, he does beautifully well on action scenes and moving the story along. So, that's one of his strong points. So what we do is after I finished a couple chapters, I send it to him. He edits it. He writes a few chapters and throws it back to me. And it goes back and forth like that, like a ping pong ball. And but because we write as we do, it never comes back like we intend it to. So I'll back him in a corner, and he'll say, "Now, how the heck am I going to get out of this one?" And then he'll work his way out and throw it back to me. And sometimes I don't know what's going to happen. So it's exciting, it's exhilarating, it's just fun.
I have another question in the chat room. My friend Delaney wants to know, what character's actions have surprised you the most?
What character's actions in all my books?
in any one of your books. In other words, has Eve ever done anything that shocked you, or Joe ever done anything that you was like out of character, but it just happened, or Catherine or John, or we won't say anything about the new guys. And and after that, I wanted you to just tell everybody just a little bit about Luke, because I love him. He's just so cool.
Okay. Well, I think that the one of the books that really surprised me was Long After Midnight. I got at least through the middle of the book, and then all of a sudden I found out that the hero wasn't a hero at all, and I had to kill him. Now that was
a complete shock.
Complete. So that was the big shocker. And what was the other question?
The question was she wanted to know she was saying that she would probably be the murder victim herself in that particular case. Now, what about the character's actions surprised you is what she wanted to know. Oh, yeah, I want to know, could you tell everybody a little bit about Luke?
All about Luke.
I love him. He's unique, let me tell you. And he's pretty grown up for his age. And I know, and he's been through a lot, but we don't want to tell too much about him.
No, we won't. They can read Chasing the Night if they want to know his in-depth story. But Luke is stunted in many ways emotionally, and he has to sort of feel his way through his relationship with his mother, Catherine. And yet, he's very grown up. He's really a warrior and a child in one. Yeah, I really love Luke.
I love Luke too, and I hope I get to see him again, because there's a lot more story in him, I know, and we won't tell anybody how the book ends. Yeah, there is. So when you write something and you want to promote it, how important is it for you to get reviews, or does it, you know, when you get reviews on your books, does that help it as far as sales, or doesn't it matter? Because, you know, I don't read anybody's review until after I review the book and write it, you know, myself. And your book I got before it came out, so that made it even easier. I don't like reading what other people think. I like what I think better, because it's my opinion. So what do you how important are reviews to you when your book comes out? Do they really help?
I hope they're very important. If they're good, I hope they're not important at all if they're bad.
I think they help.
I think they help. And they define the book in the minds of the readers. In the end, it can only, since every reader is different and every reader has their own opinions. There's no way that a reviewer can be, you know, all things to all people. Mm-hmm. But it helps. It helps.
Yeah, I know, because. I read the reviews on Amazon and all the other sites, and I can tell you now that, you know, some people just write a review and just say, oh, the book is great. My mother told me it was terrific. I'm going to love it also. And they didn't read the book. And then, of course, there's me that writes a detailed review and doesn't put any spoilers in it, people. I don't. And
Thank you.
I try not to. And as a courtesy.
Well, it's worth it for the reader. It really does, so.
Yeah, I sent your review to John, so he knows what I write. He always knows what I write before I say anything. And if he reads it, and if there's something that needs to be changed, I will change it as far as the spoilers and stuff like that. But if somebody says to me, why did you write a detailed review, and I really wanted a short one, then you should have told me that before I spent the time reading it and writing it. But we have another question in the chat room. Do you have a little bit more time?
Sure.
Oh, great. Is there anything you find particularly challenging in your writing? We have a lot of people in the chat room today. We have a lot of people listening. Is there anything when you're writing a book or writing that's particularly challenging, like any kind of obstacles when you're writing?
when I'm writing, every day is a challenge. it really is. I sit down at the computer and I write my pages sometimes, you know, you're doing bridges to make sense of your hills and valleys,
mm-hmm.
and that's a challenge just to make that portion interesting, and then every now and then you go into one of those hills or valleys and you get excited, you get really excited, you know, and after all of these years
mm-hmm.
and all of these books, it's still that way for me.
Yeah, it is a challenge to come up with the first idea. So this is the question I asked yesterday. I thought it was really interesting as I thought about it. After you write your first draft of your book, I can't tell. Is that a phone?
I am so sorry.
That's okay. My phone does that too. After you write the first draft of the book, does the book itself come out the same way, or is it totally different?
The first draft, the final draft from the first draft?
Yeah, just how different is it? Do you change the plot line, and is it different, or is it basically the same, just with some edits?
Well, when I turn it in, it's usually complete. Now, I when I talk to the editors, they usually give me a feedback, which, of course, is terribly important.
Yeah.
And then I listen to them, and we get together, and if I think something needs changing, I'll change it. But most of the time, we're mm-hmm. almost always on the same page.
In other words, when they edit the book, your son edits the grammar, correct, or any kind of typos or stuff like that, because your book doesn't have any. And maybe I should get him to edit mine, too, because he's really good.
Well, also... you know, he edits his story, too. He'll say, my son will say, Mom, I really don't think she should do that. Or don't you think we should have her jump off a cliff or something?
and do you take his advice, or do you just...
I listen, and we talk about it.
Especially if you're co-authoring it, right?
Absolutely. Like I said, it's such fun. It really is.
It must be fun. But you know what? Just to get a book published out there is really, really, really hard. And just to come up with an idea for your very first book. So which book was your very, very first one that I know I read it?
It was a book called Stormy Vows. It was a love-swept romance.
Mm.
And it was the title at that point was what was it called? It was called The Love Formula. And then my editor said, "Iris, what a terrible title! We got to change it." So we changed it. It was Stormy Vows then.
That was a long time ago.
But you know, those romances were great fun. What?
Do they ever promote the old ones?
Oh, yes. They've been re-releasing them now for like 2 or 3 years. But I wrote so many of those Love Sweats way back then that, they just sort of release maybe 3 or 4 a year.
The first book I read was my cousin emailed me and said, you have to read the first book about the Eve where Bonnie gets killed. And after that, I was hooked. And my sister that died last year definitely read all of your books. And the fun part was we had this little joke. She would call me up and say, did you get it yet? And I'd say, get what? And she said, did you read it yet? And I said to her, you don't mean this author, you mean Iris Johansson. And I knew she read you. And she said, did you read it yet? I go, I'm sending it to you. When you come in to see Mom, I'll give it to you if you're really nice to me. But you have to give it back. She never gave it back. She would pass it along to just about everybody on this planet. We had this thing. She would say, you know, I know you read Patterson, but t- did you get the Johansson book yet? Did you buy this? She never bought a book in her life. She never had to because she always had me. And now that I, you know, do the reviews, it's great because all I have to do is email John and I get your book. It's great. It's wonderful.
We
and,
love
and
it.
And I get a I love it. I get it before it comes out, which really makes it even better. And reviewing books is a lot of fun, you know, most of the time. Tell me something. If you had to review a book, which genre would you want to review? What would be your favorite one?
What would be my favorite one? Well, I think romance is very difficult to review.
Yeah, I know. I do that. They are hard.
So if I was a reviewer, I wouldn't. I love romance, as you can tell from my past. I love it.
Yeah.
I love. So I'm not really what you would call a mainstream writer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably I'd want to review the suspense because there's teeth in it, and
yeah.
And at the same time you can see the checks and balances of the emotions and the relationships. You can that's still there in the suspense book, as well as the twists and turns.
Well, you have them in your story too because you're able to keep that extra twist in the center of the story that no one's going to know how the book is going to end. You know, no one's supposed to know how the book is going to end. No one's going to figure this out anyway in this particular one either. So how do you do that? In other words, I read the book in less than 2 hours, I have to tell you. I couldn't put it down.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm a speed reader, and that was the day I said, okay, this book, it was funny.
That was a long book, too.
It was. I had 10 books that came. I don't. Neither the postman delivers none or he delivers 10. And when I see more than two, I go, oh, my God, this is not good. So I had like 6 yesterday. I think there were like 3 inside and 2 that I told the publisher that I wasn't going to read because they just really, I didn't ask to read them and they just really weren't the type of book that I'm going to do justice to. So I said, you know, I'll try one, but I'm not going to read the other one, that's for sure. But, you know, I read this and read this in less than 2 hours because I really couldn't put it down and I thought it was great. So what about it, your books, do you know that keeps the reader like stuck to the page until they're done? Because once you start your books, you can't stop until you finish it. That's it. So you may as well, you know, if you have to go to the, you know, ladies' room or you have to cook or something, you may as well take the book with you because you're not going to want to stop reading it.
Love it.
And it's the truth because my husband said to me, what are you doing? I go, he says, it's like I started the book like I had gotten it late. And I said, okay. And I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning when he left to go to work. And I go, okay, now I can finish the book. So I did, and I sit with a pad and pen next to me to take notes so that when I write the review, I have my notes in case the computer doesn't save it the right way or something goes wrong. I have it there. So what makes people want to stick to the page? What about how do you create that extra special twist in your plot so that no one puts the book down?
That's hard to say because, you know, as I said, I principally rely on the characters. I think that if the reader really likes your character, or maybe they don't like them, but they're intrigued by them, mm-hmm. that they're going to want to go on with the story. Yes, you can put a twist in, or if you can make a reader want to go on and open up some secret little plot point that you've put in, that's
mm-hmm.
great. But they wouldn't care a bit if they didn't like those characters. I think characters, are, you build a world when you're writing a book.
Mm.
And you people it with the kind of characters and the kind of villains, that you want to put in there, and then you just turn them loose and let them tell their own story.
Well,
and there's nothing more fun.
I know. Who is your very favorite villain that you wrote about?
Oh, that's hard to say. I've really had some really, really bad ones.
Yeah, I know you did.
Maybe
sometimes I like the bad characters better than the good ones.
Maybe there was a historical called The Wind Dancer. There was a villain in that who was really terrible. And maybe that was the worst one. And yet he was more complicated than many of my newer suspense villains, but he was pretty bad. Of course,
well,
the whole book. I was in tears most of the time anyway, so I was really hating that villain.
I mean, did you ever sit down when you write a book? So I had asked this of somebody else too, and write a book and say to yourself, "I wish I had killed that character off, but I couldn't do it." Was there ever a character that you killed off in a book and said, "I didn't want to do that"? Or was there ever a character in the book in which you said, "I should have gotten rid of him a long time ago"?
No. And I tell you why. Because I let the characters do what they want to do. And
mm-hmm.
when I feel at the end, I always feel as if, you know, I didn't do it. They did it. So it's okay.
Well, we have one more question in the chat room. Out of all the books that you've written, who is your favorite hero and heroine? That's from my friend Delaney. She wants to know.
Oh, so hard. So hard.
It's a hard question, I know. I didn't. I have these
yes,
are all
yes,
authors
yes,
that are listening.
I love Eve and Jane and all the people in my family. I adore Catherine Ling because she's so very strong.
Yeah,
and this new character that Roy and I did this summer, Kendra mm-hmm. Michaels, I mean, she's terrific. She's amazing. She's so much fun to work with. So it's hard. It's very hard. I'll probably go back to that book, The Wind Dancer, because, mm-hmm. As I said, I was so emotionally overwrought mm-hmm. during it that it definitely had an effect on me. And as far as romantic suspense is concerned, mm-hmm. The Ugly Duckling, that first romantic
I read that one. That was really good. I read that. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that one, I really love the characters in that. That one is why I actually started to write suspense, because I got the idea for a suspense novel. And I thought, oh, that'd be kind of cool. So I wrote it.
Yeah, that was a
wicked
one.
I was hooked. I was hooked. After that, you know, I just wanted to write suspense after suspense. And I always tell everybody, if when they tell me how much they loved the Ugly Duckling, I say, "Are you? Do you love romance?" And almost invariably, they say, "Yes, I do." And because it's a love story as well as a suspense story.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of graphic too, but it's really good though. I remember that one. That was another one that my sister took and didn't give back. I'm telling you, my sister
likes romance too, huh?
Well, my sister passed away last year, and she was my editor. And she, like I said, she used to take all my books and say to me, "Okay, once I'm done, I'll just bring them to the office," because she worked for doctors. And I go like, "Moshe, am I ever going to see the book again?" She's probably not. So you know, there were times I had to actually buy two. And for her birthday, I would say to her, "Okay, I'll get you one and me one. This way I get to read it, and you can keep one over there." So before we end, whatever, because I have a few more, tell me something. After Close Your Eyes comes out, do you think Roy would come on the show with you and do an interview so you can talk about the book together?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he'd love to. And you'll love him. He's so much fun.
I'm sure he will. That would be really good, because this is coming out when, at the end of July, you said?
I think it's the middle of July.
Middle of July.
And Kendra Michaels, You're going to really like her. Oh, and by the way, I got to say something because I hear it all the time, and I want to make sure everybody knows there is another e-book coming out in October.
Everybody's, that's what I want to know.
Everybody's been saying, oh, well, are you ending Eve? And no, I'm not. There's another e-book in October.
And I have to get that one too. Good.
That
is even better.
That one is Sleep No More.
Sleep No More.
And there's a very interesting character in that one. You'll be a little surprised. Yes.
That's even better. That's even better. You know what? I think everybody was waiting to see what you were going to do next once this story with Bonnie is sort of gone. I think they were praying that they would find Bonnie alive somewhere and that, you know, she would come back, but it's not going to happen. People forget it. But this is really going to be great. I'll Sleep No More. I'm going to have to look for it. Of course, I'm going to have to hound John until he sends it to me. So
by
we're going to have to try to set something up for September. That'll be really cool. Notice
that's
I'm talking
great.
About
that's
September.
That's great. And Roy and I will talk to you in July.
In July, yes, definitely. You have to send it. If you want to do something in July and can come on the show in July, just tell John to let me know when, because that would be great, because I didn't plan anybody in July. I planned June, and I planned June and May.
<I've> got, June and May, left out July.
July, you can have any day in July that you want. That is fine. I will email John. And what date is the book coming out exactly?
I think it's July 17th, something like
17th.
That.
17th. Oh,
but,
good. So
John will know, and it's you're gonna really like it. It's so much fun.
That would be great. So maybe he could set something up for either the 19th or the 26th, maybe the 19th or the 12th, or one of those Thursdays. That would be really great. And could you tell everybody where you can get your books?
Oh, everywhere in the world.
Everywhere in the world, and in my house too, because I've got them all.
Yeah, but yeah,
but I don't lend.
Fair.
Sorry. Well, I think tell John they said when I get this one, they have to have it autographed. That's it. He's got to figure out a way to get it to me autographed, so I can get close your eyes and I can say, okay, Iris and Mike autographed the book.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Iris.
Thank you so much, Fran. This is fun.
Any time, and I will email John after this, and I will tell him that we're going to try to set something up for July, and I will remind him 1,000 times to send me the book. Actually, I was so excited when I got this one because I didn't know I was getting it. And I was like, oh, my God, finally something that I want to read. I never get a chance to read the New York Times bestselling authors unless they send me the book, because I don't go to the bookstore to buy anything. I just go in and I say, send me this. And I know if I email John, he's amazing. You have the best publicist in the world. He's great.
Oh, he's a doll.
He is, and everybody knows about your books. And, you know, I know publicists. I've been working with so many of them that, you know, do a certain amount. I know John is just great. So thank you tons, and I will definitely email him. And I don't have your email address, so I'm going to just say thank you very, very much to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Fran.
You're welcome.
Fun.
Thank you. I'm going to announce everybody before we go. My next show is on. I'm taking a break, people. I did 3 this week. May 16th, be ready for New York Times bestselling authors Laurie Foster, Perfect Storm, Elizabeth Uhlberg, Take a Bow. The next day on May 17th, be ready for New York Times bestselling authors Robert Digoni, Murder One, the author of The Memorist and the Book of Lost Fragrances, MJ Rose. Wait till you read that and hear about that. May 22nd, we have a tentative date with Margaret McLean under oath. She is the president of the Mystery Writers of America. We're waiting to hold on that. And on May 29th, to end the month with a really big bang, we've got my favorite children's author in the universe, Patricia Polacco, followed by one of my favorite mystery writers, Steve Barry, at 5. I will put all of that on my Facebook wall. In June, we have the owner of Aegis Living, the CEO of Aegis Living, Dwayne Clark. He wrote a book, My Mother, My Son. It's absolutely fantastic. We have Robert Dagoni coming back for a second one. We've got Brian Freeman, and following him, we've got John Gilstrap, Damage Control. So that's just some to look forward to. And you just heard Iris; she's going to do July. Sandra, we are so booked. And on that note, I want to thank everyone for listening. And I said we will be back May 16th, May 17th, May 22nd, and May 29th. And on that note, Sandra, thank you so much. And does anybody else have anything to add? Okay, then I am going to say goodnight. And thank you very much, everybody. Bye.